Chapter 16 In the Hog's Head. Hermione made no mention of Harry giving Defence Against the Dark Arts lessons for 2 whole weeks after her original suggestion. Harry's detentions with Umbridge were finally over. He doubted whether the words, now etched into the back of his hand, would ever fade entirely. Ron had had 4 more Quidditch practices, and not been shouted at during the last 2. And all 3 of them had managed to vanish their mice in transfiguration. Hermione had actually progressed to vanishing kittens before the subject was broached again, on a wild, blustery evening at the end of September, when the 3 of them were sitting in the library looking up potion ingredients for Snape.
"I was wondering," Hermione said suddenly, "whether you'd thought any more about Defence Against the Dark Arts, Harry."
"Course I have," said Harry grumpily. "Can't forget it, can we, with that hag teaching us?"
"I meant the idea Ron and I had."
Ron cast her an alarmed, threatening kind of look. She frowned at him.
"Oh, all right, the idea I had, then, about you teaching us."
Harry did not answer at once. He pretended to be perusing a page of Asiatic Anti-Venoms, because he did not want to say what was in his mind. He had given the matter a great deal of thought over the past fortnight. Sometimes it seemed an insane idea, just as it had on the night Hermione had proposed it, but at others he had found himself thinking about the spells that had served him best in his various encounters with dark creatures and Death Eaters, found himself, in fact, subconsciously planning lessons.
"Well,"
he said slowly, when he could no longer pretend to find Asiatic Anti-Venoms interesting,
"yeah, I've thought about it a bit."
"And?" said Hermione eagerly.
"I don't know," said Harry, playing for time. He looked up at Ron.
"I thought it was a good idea from the start," said Ron, who seemed keener to join in this conversation now that he was sure Harry was not going to start shouting again.
Harry shifted uncomfortably in his chair. "You did listen to what I said about a load of it being luck, didn't you?" "Yes, Harry," said Hermione gently. "But all the same, there's no point pretending that you're not good at Defence Against the Dark Arts, because you are. You were the only person last year who could throw off the Imperius curse completely. You can produce a Patronus. You can do all sorts of stuff that full-grown wizards can't. Victor always said..."
Ron looked round at her so fast he appeared to crick his neck. Rubbing it, he said, "Yeah? What did Vicky say?"
"Ho, ho," said Hermione in a bored voice. "He said Harry knew how to do stuff even he didn't, and he was in the final year at Durmstrang."
Ron was looking at Hermione suspiciously.
"You're not still in contact with him, are you?"
"So what if I am?" said Hermione coolly, though her face was a little pink. "I can have a pen pal if I..."
"He didn't only want to be your pen pal," said Ron accusingly.
Hermione shook her head exasperatedly, and ignoring Ron, who was continuing to watch her, said to Harry,
"Well, what do you think? Will you teach us?"
"Just you and Ron, yeah?"
"Well," said Hermione, looking a mite anxious again, "well, now don't fly off the handle again, Harry, please. But I really think you ought to teach anyone who wants to learn. I mean, we're talking about defending ourselves against Voldemort."
"Oh, don't be pathetic, Ron. It doesn't seem fair if we don't offer the chance to other people."
Harry considered this for a moment, then said,
"Yeah, but I doubt anyone except you two would want to be taught by me. I'm a nutter, remember?"
"Well, I think you might be surprised how many people would be interested in hearing what you've got to say," said Hermione seriously.
"Look," she leaned towards him. Ron, who was still watching her with a frown on his face, leaned forwards to listen too.
"You know the first weekend in October's a Hogsmeade weekend? How would it be if we tell anyone who's interested to meet us in the village, and we can talk it over?"
"Why do we have to do it outside school?" said Ron.
"Because," said Hermione, returning to the diagram of the Chinese chomping cabbage she was copying, "I don't think Umbridge would be very happy if she found out what we were up to."
Harry had been looking forward to the weekend trip into Hogsmeade, but there was one thing worrying him.
Sirius had maintained a stony silence since he had appeared in the fire at the beginning of September. Harry knew they had made him angry by saying they didn't want him to come, but he still worried from time to time that Sirius might throw caution to the winds and turn up anyway. What were they going to do if the great black dog came bounding up the street towards them in Hogsmeade, perhaps under the nose of Draco Malfoy?
"Well, you can't blame him for wanting to get out and about," said Ron, when Harry discussed his fears with him and Hermione. "I mean, he's been on the run for over 2 years, hasn't he? And I know that can't have been a laugh, but at least he was free, wasn't he? And now he's just shut up all the time with that ghastly elf."
Hermione scowled at Ron, but otherwise ignored the slight on creature.
"The trouble is," she said to Harry, "until Voldemort—" "Oh, for heaven's sake, Ron!" comes out into the open. Sirius is going to have to stay hidden, isn't he? I mean, the stupid Ministry isn't going to realise Sirius is innocent until they accept that Dumbledore's been telling the truth about him all along. And once the fools start catching real Death Eaters again, it'll be obvious Sirius isn't one. I mean, he hasn't got the mark, for one thing."
"I don't reckon he'd be stupid enough to turn up," said Ron bracingly. "Dumbledore'd go mad if he did, and Sirius listens to Dumbledore even if he doesn't like what he hears."
When Harry continued to look worried, Hermione said, "Listen, Ron and I have been sounding out people who we thought might want to learn some proper defence against the dark arts, and there are a couple who seem interested. We've told them to meet us in Hogsmeade."
"Right," said Harry vaguely, his mind still on Sirius.
"Don't worry, Harry,"
Hermione said quietly. "You've got enough on your plate without Sirius, too." She was quite right, of course. He was barely keeping up with his homework, though he was doing much better now that he was no longer spending every evening in detention with Umbridge. Ron was even further behind with his work than Harry, because while they both had Quidditch practice twice a week, Ron also had his prefect duties. However, Hermione, who was taking more subjects than either of them, had not only finished all her homework, but was also finding time to knit more elf clothes. Harry had to admit that she was getting better. It was now almost always possible to distinguish between the hats and the socks. The morning of the Hogsmeade visit dawned bright but windy. After breakfast, they queued up in front of Filch, who matched their names to the long list of students who had permission from their parents or guardian to visit the village. With a slight pang, Harry remembered that if it hadn't been for Sirius, he would not have been going at all. When Harry reached Filch, the caretaker gave a great sniff, as though trying to detect a whiff of something from Harry. Then he gave a curt nod that set his jowls a-quiver again, and Harry walked on, out onto the stone steps and the cold, sunlit day.
Why was Filch sniffing you?"
asked Ron, as he, Harry, and Hermione set off at a brisk pace down the wide drive to the gates.
"I suppose he was checking for the smell of dung bombs," said Harry with a small laugh. "I forgot to tell you."
And he recounted the story of sending his letter to Sirius, and Filch bursting in seconds later, demanding to see the letter. To his slight surprise, Hermione found this story highly interesting, much more indeed than he did himself.
"He said he was tipped off you were ordering dung bombs. But who tipped him off?"
"I don't know," said Harry, shrugging. "Maybe Malfoy. He'd think it was a laugh."
They walked between the tall stone pillars, topped with winged boars, and turned left onto the road into the village, the wind whipping their hair into their eyes.
"Malfoy?" said Hermione sceptically. "Well, yes, maybe."
And she remained deep in thought all the way into the outskirts of Hogsmeade.
"Where are we going, anyway?" Harry asked. "The Three Broomsticks?"
"Oh, no," said Hermione, coming out of her reverie. "No, it's always packed and really noisy. I've told the others to meet us in the Hog's Head. That other pub, you know the one. It's not on the main road. I think it's a bit, you know, dodgy. But students don't normally go in there, so I don't think we'll be overheard."
They walked down the main street, past Zonko's Wizarding Joke Shop, where they were not surprised to see Fred, George and Lee Jordan, past the post office, from which owls issued at regular intervals, and turned up a side street, at the top of which stood a small inn. a battered wooden sign hung from a rusty bracket over the door, with a picture on it of a wild boar's severed head, leaking blood onto the white cloth around it. The sign creaked in the wind as they approached. All three of them hesitated outside the door.
"Well, come on,"
said Hermione, slightly nervously. Harry led the way inside. It was not at all like the Three Broomsticks, whose large bar gave an impression of gleaming warmth and cleanliness. The Hogshead Bar comprised one small, dingy and very dirty room that smelled strongly of something that might have been goats. The bay windows were so encrusted with grime that very little daylight could permeate the room, which was lit instead with the stubs of candles sitting on rough wooden tables. The floor seemed at first glance to be compressed earth, though as Harry stepped onto it, he realized that there was stone beneath what seemed to be the accumulated filth of centuries. Harry remembered Hagrid mentioning this pub in his first year.
"You get a lot of funny folk in the Hog's Head," he had said, explaining how he had won a dragon's egg from a hooded stranger there.
At the time, Harry had wondered why Hagrid had not found it odd that the stranger kept his face hidden throughout their encounter. Now he saw that keeping your face hidden was something of a fashion in the Hog's Head. There was a man at the bar whose whole head was wrapped in dirty grey bandages, though he was still managing to gulp endless glasses of some smoking, fiery substance through a slit over his mouth. Two figures shrouded in hoods sat at a table in one of the windows. Harry might have thought them dementors if they had not been talking in strong Yorkshire accents. And in a shadowy corner beside the fireplace sat a witch with a thick black veil that fell to her toes. They could just see the tip of her nose because it caused the veil to protrude slightly.
"I don't know about this, Hermione," Harry muttered as they crossed to the bar. He was looking particularly at the heavily veiled witch. "Has it occurred to you Umbridge might be under that?"
Hermione cast an appraising eye over the veiled figure.
"Umbridge is shorter than that woman," she said quietly. "And anyway, even if Umbridge does come in here, there's nothing she can do to stop us, Harry, because I've double and triple-checked the school rules. We're not out of bounds. I specifically asked Professor Flitwick whether students were allowed to come in the Hog's Head, and he said yes, but he advised me strongly to bring our own glasses. And I've looked up everything I can think of about study groups and homework groups, and they're definitely allowed. I just don't think it's a good idea if we parade what we're doing."
"No," said Harry dryly, "especially as it's not exactly a homework group you're planning, is it?"
The barman sidled towards them out of a back room. He was a grumpy-looking old man with a great deal of long grey hair and beard. He was tall and thin and looked vaguely familiar to Harry.
"What?"
he grunted.
"Three butter beers, please," said Hermione.
The man reached beneath the counter and pulled up three very dusty, very dirty bottles, which he slammed on the bar.
"Six sickles," he said.
"I'll get them," said Harry quickly, passing over the silver.
The barman's eyes travelled over Harry, resting for a fraction of a second on his scar. Then he turned away and deposited Harry's money in an ancient wooden till, whose drawer slid open automatically to receive it. Harry, Ron and Hermione retreated to the furthest table from the bar and sat down, looking around. The man in the dirty grey bandages rapped the counter with his knuckles and received another smoking drink from the barman.
"You know what?" Ron murmured, looking over at the bar with enthusiasm. "We can order anything we like in here. I bet that bloke would sell us anything. He wouldn't care. I've always wanted to try fire whiskey." "You are a prefect," snarled Hermione.
"Oh," said Ron, the smile fading from his face.
"Yeah."
"So who did you say is supposed to be meeting us?" Harry asked, wrenching open the rusty top of his butterbeer and taking a swig. "Just a couple of people," Hermione repeated, checking her watch and looking anxiously towards the door. "I told them to be here about now, and I'm sure they all know where it is. Oh, look, this might be them now."
The door of the pub had opened. A thick band of dusty sunlight split the room in two for a moment, and then vanished, blocked by the incoming rush of a crowd of people. First came Neville, with Dean and Lavender, who were closely followed by Parvati and Padma Patil, with, Harry's stomach did a backflip, Cho, and one of her usually giggling girlfriends. Then, on her own and looking so dreamy she might have walked in by accident, Luna Lovegood. Then Katie Bell, Alicia Spinett, and Angelina Johnson, Colin and Dennis Creevy, Ernie McMillan, Justin Finch-Fletchley, Hannah Abbott, a Hufflepuff girl with a long plait down her back whose name Harry did not know, three Ravenclaw boys he was pretty sure were called Anthony Goldstein, Michael Corner, and Terry Boot, Ginny, followed by a tall, skinny, blonde boy with an upturned nose, whom Harry recognised vaguely as being a member of the Hufflepuff Quidditch team, and, bringing up the rear, Fred and George Weasley, with their friend Lee Jordan, all three of whom were carrying large paper bags crammed with Zonko's merchandise.
"A couple of people," said Harry hoarsely to Hermione. "A couple of people?"
"Yes, well, the idea seemed quite popular," said Hermione happily. "Ron, do you want to pull up some more chairs?" The barman had frozen in the act of wiping out a glass with a rag so filthy it looked as though it had never been washed. Possibly he had never seen his pub so full.
"Hi," said Fred, reaching the bar first and counting his companions quickly. "Could we have 25 butterbeers, please?"
The barman glared at him for a moment, then, throwing down his rag irritably, as though he had been interrupted in something very important, he started passing up dusty butterbeers from under the bar.
"Cheers," said Fred, handing them out. "Cough up, everyone. I haven't got enough gold for all of these."
Harry watched numbly as the large, chattering group took their beers from Fred and rummaged in their robes to find coins. He could not imagine what all these people had turned up for, until the horrible thought occurred to him that they might be expecting some kind of speech, at which he rounded on Hermione. "What have you been telling people?" he said in a low voice. "What are they expecting?"
"I've told you, they just want to hear what you've got to say," said Hermione soothingly.
But Harry continued to look at her so furiously that she added quickly,
"You don't have to do anything yet. I'll speak to them first."
"Hi, Harry," said Neville, beaming and taking a seat opposite him.
Harry tried to smile back, but did not speak. His mouth was exceptionally dry. Cho had just smiled at him and sat down on Ron's right. Her friend, who had curly, reddish-blonde hair, did not smile, but gave Harry a thoroughly mistrustful look which plainly told him that, given her way, she would not be here at all. In twos and threes, the new arrivals settled around Harry, Ron, and Hermione, some looking rather excited, others curious, Luna Lovegood gazing dreamily into space. When everybody had pulled up a chair, the chatter died out. Every eye was upon Harry.
"Ah,"
said Hermione, her voice slightly higher than usual out of nerves.
"Well, hi."
The group focused its attention on her instead, though eyes continued to dart back regularly to Harry.
Well, you know why you're here. Harry here had the idea. I mean,"
Harry had thrown her a sharp look,
"I had the idea that it might be good if people who wanted to study Defence Against the Dark Arts, and I mean really study it, you know, not the rubbish that Umbridge is doing with us."
Hermione's voice became suddenly much stronger and more confident, "because nobody could call that Defence Against the Dark Arts."
"Hear, hear,"
said Anthony Goldstein, and Hermione looked heartened.
"Well, I thought it would be good if we, well, took matters into our own hands."
She paused, looked sideways at Harry, and went on.
"And by that I mean learning how to defend ourselves properly, not just in theory, but doing the real spells."
"You want to pass your Defence Against the Dark Arts OWL2, though, I bet," said Michael Corner.
"Of course I do," said Hermione at once. "But more than that, I want to be properly trained in defence, because...
She took a great breath and finished,
"because Lord Voldemort is back."
The reaction was immediate and predictable. Cho's friend shrieked and slopped butterbeer down herself. Terry Boot gave a kind of involuntary twitch. Padma Patil shuddered, and Neville gave an odd yelp that he managed to turn into a cough. All of them, however, looked fixedly, even eagerly, at Harry.
"Well, that's the plan, anyway," said Hermione. "If you want to join us, we need to decide how we're going to..."
"Where's the proof you know who's back?" said the blonde Hufflepuff player in a rather aggressive voice.
"Well, Dumbledore believes it," Hermione began.
"You mean Dumbledore believes him?" said the blonde boy, nodding at Harry. "Who are you?" said Ron, rather rudely.
"Zachariah Smith," said the boy. "And I think we've got the right to know exactly what makes him say, 'You know who's back.'"
"Look," said Hermione, intervening swiftly, "that's really not what this meeting was supposed to be about."
"It's okay, Hermione," said Harry. It had just dawned on him why there were so many people there. He thought Hermione should have seen this coming. Some of these people, maybe even most of them, had turned up in the hopes of hearing Harry's story first hand.
"What makes me say, 'You know who's back?'" he asked, looking Zacharias straight in the face.
"I saw him. But Dumbledore told the whole school what happened last year, and if you didn't believe him, you won't believe me, and I'm not wasting an afternoon trying to convince anyone."
The whole group seemed to have held its breath while Harry spoke. Harry had the impression that even the barman was listening. He was wiping the same glass with the filthy rag, making it steadily dirtier. Zacharias said dismissively,
"All Dumbledore told us last year was that Cedric Diggory got killed by you-know-who, and that you brought Diggory's body back to Hogwarts. He didn't give us details. He didn't tell us exactly how Diggory got murdered. I think we'd all like to know."
"If you've come to hear exactly what it looks like when Voldemort murders someone, I can't help you," Harry said. His temper, always so close to the surface these days, was rising again.
He did not take his eyes from Zacharias Smith's aggressive face and was determined not to look at Cho.
"I don't want to talk about Cedric Diggory, all right? So if that's what you're here for, you might as well clear out."
He cast an angry look in Hermione's direction. This was, he felt, all her fault. She had decided to display him like some sort of freak, and of course they'd all turned up to see just how wild his story was. But none of them left their seats, not even Zacharias Smith, though he continued to gaze intently at Harry.
"So," said Hermione, her voice very high-pitched again, "so, like I was saying, if you want to learn some defence, then we need to work out how we're going to do it, how often we're going to meet, and where we're going to..."
"Is it true," interrupted the girl with the long plait down her back, looking at Harry, "that you can produce a Patronus?"
There was a murmur of interest around the group at this.
"Yeah," said Harry, slightly defensively.
"A corporeal Patronus?"
The phrase stirred something in Harry's memory.
"You don't know Madame Bones, do you?" he asked.
The girl smiled.
"She's my auntie," she said. "I'm Susan Bones. She told me about your hearing. So is it really true? You make a stag Patronus?"
"Yes," said Harry.
"Blimey, Harry," said Lee, looking deeply impressed. "I never knew that."
"Mum told Ron not to spread it around," said Fred, grinning at Harry. "She said he got enough attention as it was."
"She's not wrong," mumbled Harry, and a couple of people laughed. The veiled witch, sitting alone, shifted very slightly in her seat.
"And did you kill a basilisk with that sword in Dumbledore's office?" demanded Terry Boot. "That's what one of the portraits on the wall told me when I was in there last year."
Yeah, I did, yeah," said Harry.
Justin Finch-Fletchley whistled. The Creevy brothers exchanged awestruck looks, and Lavender Brown said, "Wow," softly. Harry was feeling slightly hot around the collar now. He was determinedly looking anywhere but at Cho.
"And in our first year," said Neville to the group at large, "he saved that philological stone."
"Philosophers," hissed Hermione.
Yes, that. From you-know-who, finished Neville.
Hannah Abbott's eyes were as round as galleons.
And that's not to mention, said Cho.
Harry's eyes snapped across to her. She was looking at him, smiling. His stomach did another somersault.
All the tasks he had to get through in the Tri-Wizard tournament last year. Getting past dragons and merpeople and acromantula and things.
There was a murmur of impressed agreement around the table. Harry's insides were squirming. He was trying to arrange his face so that he did not look too pleased with himself. The fact that Cho had just praised him made it much, much harder for him to say the thing he had sworn to himself he would tell them.
Look, he said, and everyone fell silent at once. I don't want to sound like I'm trying to be modest or anything, but I had a lot of help with all that stuff.
Not with the dragon, you didn't, said Michael Corner at once. That was a seriously cool bit of flying.
Yeah, well, said Harry, feeling it would be churlish to disagree.
And nobody helped you get rid of those Dementors this summer, said Susan Bones.
No, said Harry, no, okay. I know I did bits of it without help, but the point I'm trying to make is...
Are you trying to weasel out of showing us any of this stuff? Said Zacharias Smith.
Here's an idea, said Ron loudly, before Harry could speak.
Why don't you shut your mouth?
Perhaps the word weasel had affected Ron particularly strongly. In any case, he was now looking at Zacharias as though he would like nothing better than to thump him. Zacharias flushed.
"Well, we've all turned up to learn from him, and now he's telling us he can't really do any of it," he said.
"That's not what he said," snarled Fred.
"Would you like us to clean out your ears for you?"
inquired George, pulling a long and lethal-looking metal instrument from inside one of the Zonko's bags.
"Or any part of your body, really. We're not fussy where we stick this," said Fred.
"Yes, well," said Hermione hastily. "Moving on, the point is, are we agreed we want to take lessons from Harry?"
There was a murmur of general agreement. Zacharias folded his arms and said nothing, though perhaps this was because he was too busy keeping an eye on the instrument in Fred's hand.
"Right," said Hermione, looking relieved that something had at last been settled. "Well, then, the next question is how often we do it. I really don't think there's any point in meeting less than once a week."
"Hang on," said Angelina. "We need to make sure this doesn't clash with our Quidditch practice."
"No," said Cho, "nor with ours."
"Nor ours," added Zacharias Smith.
"I'm sure we can find a night that suits everyone," said Hermione slightly impatiently. "But you know, this is rather important. We're talking about learning to defend ourselves against Voldemort's Death Eaters."
"Well said,"
barked Ernie Macmillan, who Harry had been expecting to speak long before this.
"Personally, I think this is really important. Possibly more important than anything else we'll do this year, even with our OWLs coming up."
He looked around impressively, as though waiting for people to cry, "Surely not." When nobody spoke, he went on.
"I, personally, am at a loss to see why the Ministry has foisted such a useless teacher on us at this critical period. Obviously they are in denial about the return of you-know-who. But to give us a teacher who is trying to actively prevent us from using defensive spells...
We think the reason Umbridge doesn't want us trained in defence against the dark arts," said Hermione, "is that she's got some mad idea that Dumbledore could use the students in the school as a kind of private army. She thinks he'd mobilise us against the Ministry."
Nearly everybody looked stunned at this news. Everybody except Luna Lovegood, who piped up,
"Well, that makes sense. After all, Cornelius Fudge has got his own private army."
"What?"
said Harry, completely thrown by this unexpected piece of information.
"Yes, he's got an army of heliopaths," said Luna solemnly.
"No, he hasn't," snapped Hermione.
"Yes, he has," said Luna.
"What are heliopaths?" asked Neville, looking blank.
"They're spirits of fire," said Luna,
her protuberant eyes widening so that she looked madder than ever.
"Great tall flaming creatures that gallop across the ground, burning everything in front of—"
"They don't exist, Neville," said Hermione tartly.
"Oh, yes, they do," said Luna angrily. "I'm sorry, but where's the proof of that?" snapped Hermione. "There are plenty of eyewitness accounts. Just because you're so narrow-minded, you need to have everything shoved under your nose before you—" "Him," said Ginny, in such a good imitation of Professor Umbridge that several people looked around in alarm and then laughed. "Weren't we trying to decide how often we're going to meet and have defence lessons?" "Yes," said Hermione at once. "Yes, we were. You're right, Ginny."
"Well, once a week sounds cool," said Lee Jordan.
"As long as—" began Angelina. "Yes, yes, we know about the Quidditch," said Hermione in a tense voice. "Well, the other thing to decide is where we're going to meet."
This was rather more difficult. The whole group fell silent.
"Library?"
suggested Katie Bell after a few moments.
"I can't see Madame Pince being too chuffed with us doing jinxes in the library," said Harry.
"Maybe an unused classroom," said Dean.
"Yeah," said Ron. "McGonagall might let us have hers. She did when Harry was practising for the Tri-Wizard."
But Harry was pretty certain that McGonagall would not be so accommodating this time. For all that Hermione had said about study and homework groups being allowed, he had the distinct feeling that this one might be considered a lot more rebellious.
"Right, well, we'll try to find somewhere," said Hermione. "We'll send a message round to everybody when we've got a time and a place for the first meeting."
She rummaged in her bag and produced parchment and a quill, then hesitated, rather as though she was steeling herself to say something.
I think everybody should write their name down, just so we know who was here. But I also think," she took a deep breath, "that we all ought to agree not to shout about what we're doing. So if you sign, you're agreeing not to tell Umbridge or anybody else what we're up to."
Fred reached out for the parchment and cheerfully wrote his signature. But Harry noticed at once that several people looked less happy at the prospect of putting their names on the list.
Said Zacharias slowly, not taking the parchment that George was trying to pass to him. "Well, I'm sure Ernie will tell me when the meeting is."
But Ernie was looking rather hesitant about signing too. Hermione raised her eyebrows at him.
"Well, we are prefects," Ernie burst out, "and if this list was found... Well, I mean to say, you said yourself, if Umbridge finds out..."
"You just said this group was the most important thing you'd do this year," Harry reminded him.
Yes, said Ernie. "Yes, I do believe that. It's just..." "Ernie, do you really think I'd leave that list lying around?" said Hermione testily.
"No, no, of course not," said Ernie, looking slightly less anxious. Yes, of course I'll sign."
Nobody raised objections after Ernie, though Harry saw Cho's friend give her a rather reproachful look before adding her own name. When the last person, Zacharias, had signed, Hermione took the parchment back and slipped it carefully into her bag. There was an odd feeling in the group now. It was as though they had just signed some kind of contract.
"Well, time's ticking on," said Fred briskly, getting to his feet. "George, Lee, and I have got items of a sensitive nature to purchase. We'll be seeing you all later."
In twos and threes, the rest of the group took their leave too. Cho made rather a business of fastening the catch on her bag before leaving, her long, dark curtain of hair swinging forwards to hide her face. But her friend stood beside her, arms folded, clicking her tongue, so that Cho had little choice but to leave with her. As her friend ushered her through the door, Cho looked back and waved at Harry.
"Well, I think that went quite well," said Hermione happily, as she, Harry and Ron walked out of the Hogshead into the bright sunlight a few moments later.
Harry and Ron were clutching their bottles of butterbeer.
"That Zacharias bloke's a wart," said Ron, who was glowering after the figure of Smith, just discernible in the distance.
"I don't like him much either," admitted Hermione.
"But he overheard me talking to Ernie and Hannah at the Hufflepuff table, and he seemed really interested in coming, so what could I say? But the more people the better, really. I mean, Michael Corner and his friends wouldn't have come if he hadn't been going out with Ginny."
Ron, who had been draining the last few drops from his butterbeer bottle, gagged and sprayed butterbeer down his front.
"'He's what?' spluttered Ron, outraged, his ears now resembling curls of raw beef. "'She's going out with... my sister's going... What do you mean, Michael Corner?'
"'Well, that's why he and his friends came, I think. Well, they're obviously interested in learning defence, but if Ginny hadn't told Michael what was going on...
"'When did this... when did she...'
"'They met at the Yule Ball and got together at the end of last year,' said Hermione composedly. They had turned into the High Street, and she paused outside Scrivenshaft's quill shop, where there was a handsome display of pheasant feather quills in the window. "'Hmm, I could do with a new quill.' She turned into the shop. Harry and Ron followed her.
"'Which one was Michael Corner?' Ron demanded furiously.
"'The dark one,' said Hermione.
"'I didn't like him,' said Ron at once.
"'Big surprise,' said Hermione under her breath.
"'But,'
said Ron, following Hermione along a row of quills in copper pots,
"'I thought Ginny fancied Harry.'
Hermione looked at him rather pityingly and shook her head.
"'Ginny used to fancy Harry, but she gave up on him months ago. "'Not that she doesn't like you, of course,' she added kindly to Harry, "'while she examined a long black-and-gold quill.
"'Harry, whose head was still full of Cho's parting wave, "'did not find this subject quite as interesting as Ron, "'who was positively quivering with indignation, "'but it did bring something home to him "'that until now he had not really registered.
"'So that's why she talks now?' "'he asked Hermione. "'She never used to talk in front of me.'
"'Exactly,' said Hermione. "'Yes, I think I'll have this one.' "'She went up to the counter and handed over 15 sickles and 2 knuts, "'with Ron still breathing down her neck.
"'Ron,' she said severely, as she turned and trod on his feet, "'this is exactly why Ginny hasn't told you she's seeing Michael. "'She knew you'd take it badly. "'So don't harp on about it, for heaven's sake.'
"'What do you mean? Who's taking anything badly? "'I'm not going to harp on about anything,'
Ron continued to chunter under his breath all the way down the street. Hermione rolled her eyes at Harry and then said in an undertone, while Ron was still muttering imprecations about Michael Corner,
"'And talking about Michael and Ginny, what about Cho and you?'
"'What do you mean?' said Harry quickly.
It was as though boiling water was rising rapidly inside him. A burning sensation that was causing his face to smart in the cold. Had he been that obvious?
Well, said Hermione, smiling slightly, she just couldn't keep her eyes off you, could she?
Harry had never before appreciated just how beautiful the village of Hogsmeade was.
Chapter 17 Educational Decree Number 24 Harry felt happier for the rest of the weekend than he had done all term. He and Ron spent much of Sunday catching up with all their homework again, and although this could hardly be called fun, the last burst of autumn sunshine persisted, so rather than sitting hunched over tables in the common room, they took their work outside, and lounged in the shade of a large beech tree on the edge of the lake. Hermione, who of course was up to date with all her work, brought more wool outside with her and bewitched her knitting needles so that they flashed and clicked in mid-air beside her, producing more hats and scarves. Knowing they were doing something to resist Umbridge and the Ministry, and that he was a key part of the rebellion, gave Harry a feeling of immense satisfaction. He kept reliving Saturday's meeting in his mind. All those people coming to him to learn defence against the dark arts, and the looks on their faces as they had heard some of the things he had done, and Cho praising his performance in the Triwizard Tournament, knowing all those people did not think him a lying weirdo, but someone to be admired, buoyed him up so much that he was still cheerful on Monday morning, despite the imminent prospect of all his least favourite classes. He and Ron headed downstairs from their dormitory, discussing Angelina's idea that they were to work on a new move called the Sloth Grip Roll during that night's Quidditch practice.
and not until they were halfway across the sunlit common room did they notice the addition to the room that had already attracted the attention of a small group of people. A large sign had been affixed to the Gryffindor notice board, so large it covered everything else on it, the lists of second-hand spellbooks for sale, the regular reminders of school rules from Argus Filch, the Quidditch team training timetable, the offers to barter certain chocolate frog cards for others, the Weasleys' latest advertisement for testers, the dates of the Hogsmeade weekends, and the lost and found notices. The new sign was printed in large black letters, and there was a highly official-looking seal at the bottom beside a neat and curly signature. By order of the High Inquisitor of Hogwarts, all student organizations, societies, teams, groups, and clubs are henceforth disbanded. An organization, society, team, group, or club is hereby defined as a regular meeting of three or more students. Permission to reform may be sought from the High Inquisitor, Professor Umbridge. No student organization, society, team, group, or club may exist without the knowledge and approval of the High Inquisitor. Any student found to have formed or to belong to an organization, society, team, group, or club that has not been approved by the High Inquisitor will be expelled. The above is in accordance with Educational Decree No. 24. Signed, Dolores Jane Umbridge, High Inquisitor. Harry and Ron read the notice over the heads of some anxious-looking second years.
"Does this mean they're going to shut down the Gobstones Club?" one of them asked his friend.
"I reckon you'll be OK with Gobstones," Ron said darkly, making the second year jump. "I don't think we're going to be as lucky, though, do you?" he asked Harry, as the second years hurried away. Harry was reading the notice through again. The happiness that had filled him since Saturday was gone. His insides were pulsing with rage. "This isn't a coincidence," he said, his hands forming fists. "She knows."
"She can't," said Ron at once.
"There were people listening in that pub, and let's face it, we don't know how many of the people who turned up we can trust. Any of them could have run off and told Umbridge." And he had thought they believed him, thought they even admired him. "Zachariah Smith," said Ron at once, punching a fist into his hand. "Or I thought that Michael Corner had a really shifty look, too." "I wonder if Hermione's seen this yet," Harry said, looking round at the door to the girls' dormitories. "Let's go and tell her," said Ron. He bounded forwards, pulled open the door, and set off up the spiral staircase. He was on the sixth stair when there was a loud, wailing, klaxon-like sound, and the steps melted together to make a long, smooth stone slide, like a helter-skelter. There was a brief moment when Ron tried to keep running, arms working madly like windmills. Then he toppled over backwards and shot down the newly created slide, coming to rest on his back at Harry's feet.
"I don't think we're allowed in the girls' dormitories," said Harry, pulling Ron to his feet and trying not to laugh.
Two fourth-year girls came zooming gleefully down the stone slide.
"Ooh, who tried to get upstairs?"
they giggled happily, leaping to their feet and ogling Harry and Ron.
"Me," said Ron, who was still rather dishevelled. "I didn't realise that would happen. It's not fair,"
he added to Harry, as the girls headed off for the portrait hole, still giggling madly.
"Hermione's allowed in our dormitory. How come we're not allowed?"
"Well, it's an old-fashioned rule," said Hermione, who had just slid neatly onto a rug in front of them and was now getting to her feet. "But it says in Hogwarts A History that the founders thought boys were less trustworthy than girls. Anyway, why were you trying to get in there?"
"To see you. Look at this," said Ron, dragging her over to the notice board.
Hermione's eyes slid rapidly down the notice. Her expression became stony.
"Someone must have blabbed to her,"
Ron said angrily.
They can't have done, said Hermione in a low voice.
You're so naive, said Ron. You think just because you're all honourable and trustworthy.
No, they can't have done, because I put a jinx on that piece of parchment we all signed, said Hermione grimly. Believe me, if anyone's run off and told Umbridge, we'll know exactly who they are, and they will really regret it.
What'll happen to them? Said Ron eagerly.
Well, put it this way, said Hermione. It'll make Eloise Midgen's acne look like a couple of cute freckles.
Come on, let's get down to breakfast and see what the others think.
I wonder whether this has been put up in all the houses.
It was immediately apparent on entering the Great Hall that Umbridge's sign had not only appeared in Gryffindor Tower. There was a peculiar intensity about the chatter and an extra measure of movement in the hall as people scurried up and down their tables, conferring on what they had read. Harry, Ron and Hermione had barely taken their seats when Neville, Dean, Fred, George and Ginny descended upon them.
"Did you see it?
Do you reckon she knows? What are we going to do?"
They were all looking at Harry. He glanced around to make sure there were no teachers near them.
"We're going to do it anyway, of course," he said quietly.
"Knew you'd say that,"
said George, beaming and thumping Harry on the arm.
"The prefects as well," said Fred, looking quizzically at Ron and Hermione.
"Of course," said Hermione coolly.
"Here come Ernie and Hannah Abbott," said Ron, looking over his shoulder. "And those Ravenclaw blokes and Smith. And no one looks very spotty."
Hermione looked alarmed.
"Never mind spots. The idiots can't come over here now. It'll look really suspicious. Sit down!" she mouthed to Ernie and Hannah, gesturing frantically to them to rejoin the Hufflepuff table.
"Later. We'll talk to you later."
"I'll tell Michael," said Ginny impatiently, swinging herself off her bench.
"The fool, honestly."
She hurried off towards the Ravenclaw table. Harry watched her go. Cho was sitting not far away, talking to the curly-haired friend she had brought along to the Hogshead. Would Umbridge's notice scare her off meeting them again? But the full repercussions of the sign were not felt until they were leaving the Great Hall for History of Magic.
"Harry!" "Ron!"
It was Angelina, and she was hurrying towards them, looking perfectly desperate.
"It's okay," said Harry quietly, when she was near enough to hear him. "We're still going to—"
"You realise she's including Quidditch in this?"
Angelina said over him.
"We have to go and ask permission to reform the Gryffindor team."
"What?" said Harry.
"No way,"
said Ron, appalled.
"You read the sign. It mentions teams, too.
So listen, Harry, I am saying this for the last time. Please,
please don't lose your temper with Umbridge again, or she might not let us play any more."
"Okay, okay," said Harry, for Angelina looked as though she was on the verge of tears.
"Don't worry, I'll behave myself."
"Bet Umbridge is in History of Magic," said Ron grimly, as they set off for Binns's lesson. "She hasn't inspected Binns yet. Bet me anything she's there." But he was wrong. The only teacher present when they entered was Professor Binns, floating an inch or so above his chair as usual, and preparing to continue his monotonous drone on giant wars. Harry did not even attempt to follow what he was saying today. He doodled idly on his parchment, ignoring Hermione's frequent glares and nudges, until a particularly painful poke in the ribs made him look up angrily.
"What?"
She pointed at the window. Harry looked round. Hedwig was perched on the narrow window ledge, gazing through the thick glass at him, a letter tied to her leg. Harry could not understand it. They had just had breakfast. Why on earth hadn't she delivered the letter then, as usual? Many of his classmates were pointing out Hedwig to each other, too.
"Oh, I've always loved that owl. She's so beautiful,"
Harry heard Lavender sigh to Parvati. He glanced round at Professor Binns, who continued to read his notes, serenely unaware that the class's attention was even less focused upon him than usual. Harry slipped quietly off his chair, crouched down, and hurried along the row to the window, where he slid the catch and opened it very slowly. He had expected Hedwig to hold out her leg so that he could remove the letter and then fly off to the owlery. But the moment the window was open wide enough, she hopped inside, hooting dolefully. He closed the window with an anxious glance at Professor Binns, crouched low again, and sped back to his seat with Hedwig on his shoulder. He regained his seat, transferred Hedwig to his lap, and made to remove the letter tied to her leg. Only then did he realize that Hedwig's feathers were oddly ruffled. Some were bent the wrong way, and she was holding one of her wings at an odd angle.
"She's hurt!"
Harry whispered, bending his head low over her. Hermione and Ron leaned in closer. Hermione even put down her quill.
"Look, there's something wrong with her wing!"
Hedwig was quivering. When Harry made to touch the wing, she gave a little jump, all her feathers on end, as though she was inflating herself, and gazed at him reproachfully.
"Professor Binns," said Harry loudly, and everyone in the class turned to look at him. "I'm not feeling well."
Professor Binns raised his eyes from his notes, looking amazed, as always, to find the room in front of him full of people.
"Not feeling well?" he repeated hazily.
"Not at all well," said Harry firmly, getting to his feet with Hedwig concealed behind his back.
"I think I need to go to the hospital wing."
"Yes," said Professor Binns, clearly very much wrong-footed.
"Yes, yes, hospital wing. Well, off you go then, Perkins."
Once outside the room, Harry returned Hedwig to his shoulder and hurried off up the corridor, pausing to think only when he was out of sight of Binns's door. His first choice of somebody to cure Hedwig would have been Hagrid, of course. But as he had no idea where Hagrid was, his only remaining option was to find Professor Grubbly Plank and hope she would help. He peered out of a window at the blustery, overcast grounds. There was no sign of her anywhere near Hagrid's cabin. If she was not teaching, she was probably in the staff room. He set off downstairs, Hedwig hooting feebly as she swayed on his shoulder. Two stone gargoyles flanked the staff-room door. As Harry approached, one of them croaked,
"You should be in class, Sonny Jim."
"This is urgent," said Harry curtly.
"Oh, urgent, is it?" said the other gargoyle in a high-pitched voice. "Well, that's put us in our place, hasn't it?"
Harry knocked. He heard footsteps, then the door opened, and he found himself face to face with Professor McGonagall.
"You haven't been given another detention,"
she said at once, her square spectacles flashing alarmingly.
"No, Professor," said Harry hastily.
"Well, then, why are you out of class?"
"It's urgent, apparently,"
said the second gargoyle, snidely.
"I'm looking for Professor Grubbly Plank," Harry explained. "It's my owl. She's injured."
"Injured owl, did you say?"
Professor Grubbly Plank appeared at Professor McGonagall's shoulder, smoking a pipe and holding a copy of the Daily Prophet.
"Yes," said Harry, lifting Hedwig carefully off his shoulder. "She turned up after the other post-owls, and her wing's all funny. Look!"
Professor Grubbly Plank stuck her pipe firmly between her teeth and took Hedwig from Harry, while Professor McGonagall watched.
"Hmm,"
said Professor Grubbly Plank, her pipe waggling slightly as she talked.
"Looks like something's attacked her. Can't think what would have done it, though. Thestrals will sometimes go for birds, of course, but Hagrid's got the Hogwarts thestrals, well trained not to touch owls."
Harry neither knew nor cared what thestrals were. He just wanted to know that Hedwig was going to be all right. Professor McGonagall, however, looked sharply at Harry and said,
"Do you know how far this owl's travelled, Potter?"
Said Harry. "From London, I think." He met her eyes briefly, and knew by the way her eyebrows had joined in the middle that she understood London to mean No. 12, Grim Old Place. Professor Grubbly Plank pulled a monocle out of the inside of her robes and screwed it into her eye to examine Hedwig's wing closely.
"I should be able to sort this out if you leave her with me, Potter," she said. She shouldn't be flying long distances for a few days, in any case.
Right, thanks, said Harry, just as the bell rang for break.
No problem, said Professor Grubbly Plank gruffly, turning back into the staff room.
Just a moment, Wilhelmina, said Professor McGonagall. Potter's letter.
Oh, yeah, said Harry, who had momentarily forgotten the scroll tied to Hedwig's leg. Professor Grubbly Plank handed it over and then disappeared into the staff room, carrying Hedwig, who was staring at Harry as though unable to believe he would give her away like this. Feeling slightly guilty, he turned to go, but Professor McGonagall called him back.
Potter?
Yes, Professor?
She glanced up and down the corridor. There were students coming from both directions. Bear in mind, she said quickly and quietly, her eyes on the scroll in his hand, that channels of communication in and out of Hogwarts may be being watched, won't you?
I, said Harry.
But the flood of students rolling along the corridor was almost upon him. Professor McGonagall gave him a curt nod and retreated into the staff room, leaving Harry to be swept out into the courtyard with the crowd. He spotted Ron and Hermione already standing in a sheltered corner, their cloak collars turned up against the wind. Harry slit open the scroll as he hurried towards them and found five words in Sirius's handwriting.
Today, same time, same place.
Is Hedwig okay? Asked Hermione anxiously the moment he was within earshot.
Where did you take her? Asked Ron.
To Grubbly Plank, said Harry, and I met McGonagall. Listen. And he told them what Professor McGonagall had said. To his surprise, neither of the others looked shocked. On the contrary, they exchanged significant looks.
What? Said Harry, looking from Ron to Hermione and back again.
Well, I was just saying to Ron, what if someone had tried to intercept Hedwig? I mean, she's never been hurt on a flight before, has she?
"'Who's the letter from, anyway?' asked Ron, taking the note from Harry.
"'Snuffles,' said Harry quietly.
"'Same time, same place. Does it mean the fire in the common room?'
"'Obviously,' said Hermione, also reading the note. She looked uneasy. "'I just hope nobody else has read this.'
"'But it was still sealed and everything,' said Harry, trying to convince himself as much as her. And nobody would understand what it meant if they didn't know where we'd spoken to him before, would they?
I don't know, said Hermione anxiously, hitching her bag back over her shoulder as the bell rang again. It wouldn't be exactly difficult to reseal the scroll by magic, and if anyone's watching the Flu Network. But I don't really see how we can warn him not to come without that being intercepted too.
They trudged down the stone steps to the dungeons for potions. All three of them lost in thought. But as they reached the bottom of the steps, they were recalled to themselves by the voice of Draco Malfoy, who was standing just outside Snape's classroom door, waving around an official-looking piece of parchment and talking much louder than was necessary, so that they could hear every word.
"Yeah, Umbridge gave the Slytherin Quidditch team permission to continue playing straight away. I went to ask her first thing this morning. Well, it was pretty much automatic. I mean, she knows my father really well. He's always popping in and out of the ministry. It'll be interesting to see whether Gryffindor are allowed to keep playing, won't it?
Don't rise, Hermione whispered imploringly to Harry and Ron, who were both watching Malfoy, faces set and fists clenched. It's what he wants.
I mean, said Malfoy, raising his voice a little more, his grey eyes glittering malevolently in Harry and Ron's direction. If it's a question of influence with the Ministry, I don't think they've got much chance. From what my father says, they've been looking for an excuse to sack Arthur Weasley for years. And as for Potter, my father says it's a matter of time before the Ministry has him carted off to St. Mungo's. Apparently they've got a special ward for people whose brains have been addled by magic.
Malfoy made a grotesque face, his mouth sagging open and his eyes rolling. Crabbe and Goyle gave their usual grunts of laughter. Pansy Parkinson shrieked with glee. Something collided hard with Harry's shoulder, knocking him sideways. A split second later, he realised that Neville had just charged past him, heading straight for Malfoy.
"'Neville, no!'
Harry leapt forward and seized the back of Neville's robes. Neville struggled frantically, his fists flailing, trying desperately to get at Malfoy, who looked, for a moment, extremely shocked.
"Help me!"
Harry flung at Ron, managing to get an arm around Neville's neck and dragging him backwards, away from the Slytherins. Crabbe and Goyle were flexing their arms as they stepped in front of Malfoy, ready for the fight. Ron seized Neville's arms, and together he and Harry succeeded in dragging Neville back into the Gryffindor line. Neville's face was scarlet. The pressure Harry was exerting on his throat rendered him quite incomprehensible, but odd words spluttered from his mouth.
"Not funny. Don't, Mungos, show him."
The dungeon door opened. Snape appeared there. His black eyes swept up the Gryffindor line to the point where Harry and Ron were wrestling with Neville.
"Fighting, Potter, Weasley, Longbottom?" Snape said in his cold, sneering voice. 10 points from Gryffindor. Release Longbottom, Potter, or it will be detention. Inside, all of you."
Harry let go of Neville, who stood panting and glaring at him.
"I had to stop you," Harry gasped, picking up his bag. "Crabbe and Goyle would have torn you apart."
Neville said nothing. He merely snatched up his own bag and stalked off into the dungeon.
"What in the name of Merlin," said Ron slowly, as they followed Neville, "was that about?"
Harry did not answer. He knew exactly why the subject of people who were in St. Mungo's because of magical damage to their brains was highly distressing to Neville. But he had sworn to Dumbledore that he would not tell anyone Neville's secret. Even Neville did not know Harry knew. Harry, Ron, and Hermione took their usual seats at the back of the class, pulled out parchment quills and their copies of 1,000 Magical Herbs and Fungi. The class around them was whispering about what Neville had just done, but when Snape closed the dungeon door with an echoing bang, everybody immediately fell silent.
"You will notice," said Snape, in his low, sneering voice, "that we have a guest with us today."
He gestured towards the dim corner of the dungeon, and Harry saw Professor Umbridge sitting there, clipboard on her knee. He glanced sideways at Ron and Hermione, his eyebrows raised. Snape and Umbridge, the two teachers he hated most. It was hard to decide which one he wanted to triumph over the other.
"We are continuing with our strengthening solution today. You will find your mixtures as you left them last lesson. If correctly made, they should have matured well over the weekend. Instructions," he waved his wand again, "on the board. Carry on."
Professor Umbridge spent the first half hour of the lesson making notes in her corner. Harry was very interested in hearing her question Snape, so interested that he was becoming careless with his potion again.
"Salamander blood, Harry,"
Hermione moaned, grabbing his wrist to prevent him adding the wrong ingredient for the third time.
"Not pomegranate juice."
"Right," said Harry vaguely, putting down the bottle and continuing to watch the corner. Umbridge had just got to her feet. "Ha," he said softly, as she strode between two lines of desks towards Snape, who was bending over Dean Thomas's cauldron.
"Well, the class seem fairly advanced for their level," she said briskly to Snape's back, "though I would question whether it is advisable to teach them a potion like the strengthening solution. I think the Ministry would prefer it if that was removed from the syllabus."
Snape straightened up slowly and turned to look at her.
"Now, how long have you been teaching at Hogwarts?" she asked, her quill poised over her clipboard.
14 years, Snape replied. His expression was unfathomable. His eyes on Snape, Harry added a few drops to his potion. It hissed menacingly and turned from turquoise to orange.
"You applied first for the Defence Against the Dark Arts post, I believe?"
Professor Umbridge asked Snape. "Yes," said Snape quietly.
But you were unsuccessful?
Snape's lip curled. Obviously. Professor Umbridge scribbled on her clipboard.
And you have applied regularly for the Defence Against the Dark Arts post since you first joined the school, I believe.
Yes, said Snape quietly, barely moving his lips. He looked very angry.
Do you have any idea why Dumbledore has consistently refused to appoint you?
Asked Umbridge. I suggest you ask him, said Snape jerkily.
Oh, I shall, said Professor Umbridge with a sweet smile.
I suppose this is relevant, Snape asked, his black eyes narrowed.
Oh, yes, said Professor Umbridge. Yes, the Ministry wants a thorough understanding of teachers' backgrounds.
She turned away, walked over to Pansy Parkinson, and began questioning her about the lessons. Snape looked round at Harry, and their eyes met for a second. Harry hastily dropped his gaze to his potion, which was now congealing foully and giving off a strong smell of burned rubber.
"No marks again, then, Potter?" said Snape maliciously, emptying Harry's cauldron with a wave of his wand. "You will write me an essay on the correct composition of this potion, indicating how and why you went wrong, to be handed in next lesson. Do you understand?"
"Yes," said Harry furiously. Snape had already given them homework, and he had Quidditch practice this evening. This would mean another couple of sleepless nights. It did not seem possible that he had awoken that morning feeling very happy. All he felt now was a fervent desire for this day to end. "Maybe I'll skive off divination," he said glumly, as they stood in the courtyard after lunch, the wind whipping at the hems of robes and brims of hats. "I'll pretend to be ill and do Snape's essay instead. Then I won't have to stay up half the night."
"You can't skive off divination," said Hermione severely.
"Hark, who's talking? You walked out of divination. You hate Trelawney," said Ron indignantly.
"I don't hate her," said Hermione loftily. "I just think she's an absolutely appalling teacher and a real old fraud. But Harry's already missed History of Magic, and I don't think he ought to miss anything else today."
There was too much truth in this to ignore. So half an hour later, Harry took his seat in the hot, over-perfumed atmosphere of the divination classroom, feeling angry at everybody. Professor Trelawney was yet again handing out copies of The Dream Oracle. Harry thought he'd surely be much better employed doing Snape's punishment essay than sitting here trying to find meaning in a lot of made-up dreams. It seemed, however, that he was not the only person in divination who was in a temper. Professor Trelawney slammed a copy of the Oracle down on the table between Harry and Ron and swept away, her lips pursed. She threw the next copy of the Oracle at Seamus and Dean, narrowly avoiding Seamus's head, and thrust the final one into Neville's chest with such force that he slipped off his poof.
"Well, carry on,"
said Professor Trelawney loudly, her voice high-pitched and somewhat hysterical.
"You know what to do, or am I such a substandard teacher that you have never learned how to open a book?"
The class stared perplexedly at her, then at each other. Harry, however, thought he knew what was the matter. As Professor Trelawney flounced back to the high-backed teacher's chair, her magnified eyes full of angry tears, he leaned his head closer to Ron's and muttered, "I think she's got the results of her inspection back."
"Professor,"
said Parvati Patil in a hushed voice. She and Lavender had always rather admired Professor Trelawney.
"Professor, is there anything wrong?"
"Wrong!"
cried Professor Trelawney in a voice throbbing with emotion.
"Certainly not. I have been insulted, certainly. Insinuations have been made against me, unfounded accusations levelled. But no, there is nothing wrong, certainly not."
She took a great shuddering breath and looked away from Parvati, angry tears spilling from under her glasses.
"I say nothing
she choked, "of 16 years of devoted service. It has passed, apparently, unnoticed. But I shall not be insulted. No, I shall not."
"But, Professor, who's insulting you?" asked Parvati timidly.
"The establishment," said Professor Trelawney in a deep, dramatic, wavering voice. "Yes, those with eyes too clouded by the mundane to see as I see, to know as I know. Of course, we seers have always been feared, always persecuted. It is, alas, our fate."
She gulped, dabbed at her wet cheeks with the end of her shawl. Then she pulled a small embroidered handkerchief from her sleeve and blew her nose very hard, with a sound like Peeves blowing a raspberry. Ron sniggered. Lavender shot him a disgusted look. "Professor," said Parvati, "do you mean, is it something Professor Umbridge?"
"Do not speak to me about that woman!"
cried Professor Trelawney, leaping to her feet, her beads rattling and her spectacles flashing.
"Kindly continue with your work."
And she spent the rest of the lesson striding among them, tears still leaking from behind her glasses, muttering what sounded like threats under her breath.
"May well choose to leave. The indignity of it. On probation. We shall see. How she dares!"
"You and Umbridge have got something in common," Harry told Hermione quietly when they met again in Defence Against the Dark Arts. "She obviously reckons Trelawney's an old fraud, too. Looks like she's put her on probation." Umbridge entered the room as he spoke, wearing her black velvet bow and an expression of great smugness.
"Good afternoon, class."
"Good afternoon, Professor Umbridge," they chanted drearily.
"Wands away, please."
But there was no answering flurry of movement this time. Nobody had bothered to take out their wands.
"Please turn to page 34 of Defensive Magical Theory and read the third chapter, entitled The Case for Non-Offensive Responses to Magical Attack. There will be
no need to talk," Harry, Ron, and Hermione said together under their breaths.